Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Conservative foreign policy maven Elliot Cohen was not shy about his opposition to the candidacy of Donald Trump before last fall's election. The Iraq War proponent and foreign policy hawk did not see the right stuff in Trump, still doesn't, and he's worried. This hour On Point, Elliot Cohen on Trump and the world. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. One of the things that Elliot Cohen has expressed concern about is the number of generals in high positions of influence beyond the military under the presidency of Donald Trump. Before we speak with Mr. Cohen, let's turn to the influence of one of those generals, John Kelly, retired Marine Corps general, now serving as President Trump's chief of staff. Let's look at what his influence in the White House right now. To do that, joining me from Washington is Tara Palmieri, White House reporter for Politico. Tara Palmieri, welcome to us On Point. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So we've seen this tough guy, John Kelly, come into the White House, and we've seen him in press conferences where the president's been speaking with pretty long face sometimes. We've seen reports that he's taken the reins in a pretty sharp way, but that the president may not like that. Maybe he does. We've seen reports even that he might be going. Is John Kelly digging in at the White House? Is he there to stay?
He is there not for the same reasons that his predecessor was there for. He's there to you know, straighten up the White House and really help sort of bring more professionalism and order to a place that was sort of a social hub, a chaotic place where people were free to not attend meetings, to defy the chief of staff, even mock him. And really everyone seemed to be sort of creating their own alliances and silos. And John Kelly wants to create one silo underneath him. And of course, above him is the president of the United States. So he has a tough task, and I think he realized that in order to do that, he needs to get rid of people who were pretty firmly planted in a way that perhaps was not helpful because it was, you know, the problem with Trump is that he, like, spoken to many different advisors, and they had too much access to him, and when they had different opinions, and they had really, you know, found ways to make those arguments known to Trump without the chief of staff, it was causing issues, especially when dealing with policy.
So can Omarosa still sashay into the Oval Office?
Not anymore. And, you know, Trump likes Omarosa a lot. She's the one who really helped him with his apprentice fame. I mean, she was one of the first seasons. She's on the first season. She was a hit. You know, she made the show what it is, and he's thankful to her for that. But it's really unclear what her role is. They created one for her called the Director of Communications for the Office of Public Liaison. This is a role that has never been in a prior White House. It's really unclear what she does because she doesn't actually deal with the press. And, you know, John Kelly's evaluating, why do we have these jobs that are very untraditional and perhaps useless in the White House when we have so many openings as well? So she's not really on solid footing right now. He met with each staffer to ask them exactly what do they do and how do they contribute to, you know, the agendas of the White House. And you know, you saw some people move from less traditional roles, like Hope Hicks, who's the director of strategic communication, to moving on to being the director of communication. So, you know, this is what we're starting to see, a more traditional White House. And of course, there's resistance to that. But everyone who's been resistant to it has really been shown the door.
Did Steve Bannon head out because John Kelly came in?
Steve Bannon wanted to stay with John Kelly. He really did. He really kind of like stayed to himself and, you know, attended meetings and tried to be on his best behavior. He really made it a point to show that he respected the, you know, the new hierarchy, because when Reince was brought on, Steve and Reince were on the same level. They were equals.
When Reince Priebus had the job of chief of staff, but General Kelly comes from a world of hierarchy in the military, retired general.
Exactly.
What about the president? I mean, you may have a more traditional White House, but you have an untraditional president. What about his information flow, what he sees, what he reads? We read that Kelly is shaping that in a pretty austere way. How?
Well, in the past, there would be a file, like a dossier, you could say, and it would be compiled with all of the press clips throughout the day, and aides would sneak in press clippings that they wanted Trump to see. You know, these are clippings that aren't from the traditional news outlets like the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Post, that he would read in print every day. So the way to get Trump to pay attention to news that isn't in a traditional format like television or newspapers, they would slip these articles into the packet so that he could see them. And Kelly has really put a clamp on that. He's really trying to stop that. It's no longer possible. I mean, people used to be able to walk in and out of the Oval Office at their whim, and Trump liked it that way. In fact, he's suffering a little bit from what my sources say, from the isolation that Kelly has imposed on him. Although he said that he has more time to think, he also, you know, he likes being around people. He's a social animal. It's interesting because he admitted that he wasn't quite sure what some of the people that work with him do, like Seb Gorka. He told one of his colleagues, according to my sources, Seb, he's so great on TV, but I really have no idea what he does. And he was his counterterrorism advisor.
Yeah, Sebastian Gorka. General Kelly can control who comes in, I guess, and what comes in, maybe in terms of information.
Right.
Hard to control what goes out. What about the president's tweeting? Does he have any influence over that?
No, and he knew that taking the job. He knew that he couldn't control the tweeting. I was surprised to see a report saying that Kelly was going to try to clamp down on the tweeting. That is not true, and he knew that. There's one thing, there's one thing that he really knew that taking the job, you would not have control over that. Trump feels that he's able to change the news cycle and the conversation with his tweeting, which is true. And while a lot of people may find it to be offensive, he's able to really change the conversation and to move the news cycle, whether it's in, you know, people contesting the tweet or analyzing it or just talking about it.
Is this social animal, the president, is he content with this more policed environment around him? We read that his longtime bodyguard, Keith Schiller, who's been with him forever and ever, there were reports that he's thinking of leaving the president. Is the president all right with Kelly's discipline around him? Will Kelly last?
I'm not sure. Right now, Trump, I think, realizes he's in a really, you know, tough state because he can't really get rid of Kelly. Who's going to replace him? It doesn't look good to have all these staffers cycling in and out. He needs to stay, you know, in a sense, he needs to behave for Kelly because Kelly made it clear that he's willing to leave if he's not happy with the way things are going. But Trump at the end of the day needs him, and he'll never admit that, but he really does. But I've heard he's very unhappy. He's upset that Keith is leaving. Keith isn't leaving because of Kelly. Keith is leaving because he's having some personal issues. He's going through divorce, and he, you know, obviously a civil servant salary is not the same as what he was making before. But, you know, Trump's upset about that, but Keith also made it clear to some staffers, according to my sources, that he wasn't a big fan of the way that Kelly was really almost putting Trump in a cage.
Lots of generals around this president. General John Kelly, chief of staff, right there in the inner circle and patrolling it. Tara Palmieri covering this for Politico. Tara, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Not everybody's happy about the number of generals that Donald Trump has brought into his inner circle. H.R. McMaster as his national security advisor. Of course, General John Kelly, former Marine general, as his chief of staff. You've got a very recent active, but now not, but recently, General James Mattis as Secretary of Defense, a position normally held by a civilian. Among those who have had second thoughts about this is Elliot Cohen, professor at Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. Directs the Philip Merrill Center for Strategic Studies there. He was counselor at the Department of State under Condoleezza Rice from 2007 to 2009. Been a big conservative voice, foreign policy hawk voice for a long time, proponent of the Iraq War, which Donald Trump was very critical of on the campaign trail. Elliot Cohen joins us now from Washington. Elliot Cohen, thanks for being here.
Good to be with you.
What's the unease engendered in you by the number of generals in very high positions around Donald Trump? You're a hawk. People might have thought, well, Elliot would like that.
Well, I'm not sure I would accept that characterization, but quite apart from that, I mean, the most important thing to be alarmed about Donald Trump is Donald Trump. There are a bunch of secondary things. I've known each of these men, McMaster, Kelly, Mattis, for a very long time. And as individuals, I have nothing but the highest regard for them as human beings and as commanders. And in the case of Mattis in particular, I testified to the Senate to help get the law changed that would allow him to serve. Mm-hmm. At one level, I'm glad they're there because they are sane, orderly people who will contain an extremely erratic president and limit some of the damage that he might otherwise do. So I have to – let me stipulate that. Mm-hmm. In the long run, though, there is a problem with the great republic as we think of the United States heaving a giant sigh of relief that we've got a benign junta around a somewhat crazy president. This is not good in the long term for American civil-military relations. I stipulate that I'm glad at the moment they are there. It's just that we need to understand that this does raise some pretty problematic issues in the long haul.
A somewhat crazy president and a benign junta. I mean, you've always got a way of framing things that gets our attention. Overall, how's the ship of state doing on foreign policy? It's your meat. How are we doing?
Terribly. Now, some of that is not Trump's fault. He inherited a very difficult situation. All presidents do. He whinges about it a little bit more than some, but the Obama people whinged about the Bush administration, and the Bush administration whinged about Clinton. And some of the damage that has been done is not attributable to Trump. The Secretary of State has done a lot of damage there, which perhaps we could talk about after the break.
Elliot Cohen, hold the thought. We certainly will. There's a lot to look at. We'll take a little tour of the world. Elliot Cohen's here. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS consumeraccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Elliot Cohen, big conservative, foreign policy hawk, big critic of Donald Trump, about the Trump administration, the generals in and around the White House, and American foreign policy right now. His latest book, The Big Stick, The Limits of Soft Power and the Necessity of Military Force. He was a strong proponent of the Iraq War. He's watching everything going on right now in the White House and the conduct of U.S. foreign policy, State Department, barely staffed, budget maybe coming down there, and much more. You can join the conversation this hour. What grade would you give the Trump administration on foreign policy so far in the Mideast, China, North Korea, U.S. allies? Are you watching what's happening with the sidelining, gutting of the State Department? Here was the president-elect in December of last year at a rally in Cincinnati announcing he was appointing retired General James Mattis as Secretary of Defense.
We are going to appoint Mad Dog Mattis as our Secretary of Defense. But we're not announcing it till Monday, so don't tell anybody. Mad Dog. He's great.
But he knows more about the generals, he said. 2015 campaign rally.
I know more about ISIS than the generals do, believe me.
Okay, there's Donald Trump on the general that he put in charge of the Department of Defense and on generals generally. Elliot Cohen has seen a lot in a big career in foreign policy. Some of it controversial, always strongly put. You say the problem starts with Donald Trump, and you've been saying that since March of last year, well before the election. What's your fundamental critique of the president? Of course, he's got a critique of you and the Iraq War, but what's your critique of this president, Elliot Cohen?
Oh, my critique of this president is, first and foremost, rotten character. He's a liar, a bully, an ignoramus, and a demagogue. And that's just the beginning of the list. I mean, he is a reprehensible human being. And that, you know, ultimately, as someone once said, character is destiny. And that is our fundamental problem with Donald Trump, not, you know, nuances of policy differences. Now, those clips that you just played are revealing. Mm-hmm. And they're revealing about his ignorance. They're also revealing about his ego. You notice he uses the royal we, which is a little bit troubling. But more importantly, when he refers to Jim Mattis as Mad Dog, I know General Mattis. I spent time with General Mattis in his headquarters in outside Ramadi, Iraq. I can assure you there is nobody that I know who calls him Mad Dog. And there's nobody who's less like a Mad Dog in command. He was commanding 1st Marine Division when I was visiting him. This is a very tough individual. This is a great military leader. This is a thoughtful officer who has a very substantial library, and I can assure you he's read those books. He's not a mad dog. And it tells you something about Donald Trump, that he understands the military so little that that's what he thinks is appealing about him.
But you heard that roar of approval from the crowd in Cincinnati when he announced who the Secretary of Defense would be in just that way. Mad Dog Mattis. Twice you said it. Mad Dog Mattis, and that big roar of approval. When you say it's the royal we, but in a way, he's saying we, that is, myself, Donald Trump, and you, my enthusiastic audience, that we responded, at least in part, to Donald Trump's critique of American foreign policy as he came in. It wasn't just Barack Obama. It was before that. He was very hard on American interventionism, very hard, though, you know, people will say, well, he supported it to begin with, but very hard.
He did support the Iraq War to begin with. So this is more of a case of him just being a liar.
Fair enough. But he came out on the campaign trail saying that should not have been done. So he might look at you and say, look, Elliot Cohen, you were among that crew that took us into the Iraq War. George Will called it the worst foreign policy decision in U.S. history. That cost us dearly. Why should I take your critique of foreign policy if you took us into that blunder?
Well, you know, that I think most people realize that's actually not an argument. I might respond to him, Donald Trump, unlike you, I went to Iraq, and unlike you, I've got a son who served in Iraq. So perhaps that puts us on the same plane. But more importantly, if that is the disqualifying question, whether or not you supported the Iraq War, then you should disqualify most major newspapers in this country. You should probably disqualify most of the House of Representatives and the Senate, most of the allied governments that we have. It's a silly argument. It's an ad hominem argument. It's a ridiculous argument. And it has nothing to do with the limits and failures of Donald Trump as a president. What you heard was the roar of a crowd responding to a demagogue, and that's what he is. He is a very effective demagogue. He plays to our worst instincts. That was a relatively mild case. What he did after Charlottesville was a heck of a lot worse, and it tells you something fundamental about who this man is. And again, I would emphasize, it's not that I disagree with policy positions, although there are plenty of those I disagree with. It's my view of his character.
There was a moment after the election last fall, you have written, that you were advising conservatives to enter this administration and help the Donald Trump govern and conduct foreign policy. You turned around on that and ended up advising people to stay out. Why?
That happened pretty quickly. It was a result of an exchange with somebody on the transition team, who I'm not going to say who it was, who had initially reached out to me, said, could you put forward names? There's no question that I would ever serve in this administration. They would never want me, and I wouldn't want them. And, you know, I thought hard about it. I teach at a school which has sent a lot of people into public service in both Democratic and Republican administrations. I do believe when the president asks you to serve your country, the default answer should be yes. And what happened, what I saw in the exchange was that there was a kind of a crazy level of anger and animus and suspicion and hostility, which made me realize that, you know, these people are not stable. And as time has gone on, I'm increasingly of the view that although I absolutely encourage people to serve in the military, to serve in the foreign service, in the intelligence services, in the civil service, and although there are some political appointee positions where I don't think you risk compromising your integrity, in a lot of others you do. Because when you are a political appointee in the government, you are put there effectively by the president. Mm-hmm. And if you have to be able to support him. and you have to be able to support his positions. And if you can't, you're being dishonest. And supporting this man and supporting this man's positions, I think, does risk compromising your character and your integrity. And there's nothing that's worth that. Your country, I firmly believe your country can ask you, if you're in uniform, to risk your life for it. And in wartime, it can draft you and say, we're going to ask you to risk your life for the country. The country cannot ask you to risk your character and your integrity for it.
Are Generals Kelly, Mattis, and McMaster risking their character, their reputations right now?
I think they – I haven't talked with any of them since they went into government, although I've had plenty of talks with them before. I think all three of them are aware of some of the perils that they run. And you saw it in that anguished look on John Kelly's face as he listened to the president talk about Charlottesville. Mm-hmm. And as I said in an article, if he had been in the business world and serving on a board, and that had been the chairman of the board speaking, I'm quite confident that John Kelly would have left that stage and would have resigned from that board within the hour. But you can't do that when you're the chief of staff to the president, so you have to be silent. And sometimes being silent when terrible things are being said, it does something to you. And so I think all three, I don't judge them. I wouldn't presume to advise them. They don't need my advice, and they probably don't want it. But of course they're putting themselves in some jeopardy, and I suspect they know it.
There's a lot to look at here, and we want to kind of spin the globe and do that. But before we do, let's slow down for a second on the general's business, because I heard you say in your opening, Sally, on this, that in some way you're glad they're there, but you've got a deep unease about it. Donald Trump has pointed to his naming of generals to his inner circle as a sign of strength, of bringing in guys who know how the world works and know how to get things done. But it clearly inspires unease in you. Benign hunter, you describe it. And just slow down and describe why that brings you unease.
Well, there are a number of reasons for it. Again, let me begin with how Trump frames it. He likes to talk about my generals. They're not his generals. They're our generals. And I think the appeal of general officers to him is that they are tough guys. And he likes to portray himself as a tough guy. And that's why he likes the Mad Dog Mattis thing. And, he's even talked about generals from central casting. He likes the way they took. He doesn't actually know anything about the military. He somehow got 5 draft deferments during Vietnam. But he has this almost adolescent view of it. So substantively, what's the problem in the long term? One of the things we hold dear is the idea that the military is apolitical, that they serve with equal fidelity, Democrats, Republicans, liberals, conservatives, and that they maintain something of a firewall between themselves and politics. This mm-hmm. runs the risk of blurring that. Secondly, it's not true that generals are omnicompetent. I think, obviously, can make sense to have a couple. But in the same way, I wouldn't want a government run by a bunch of professors. I don't like the idea of a government run by a bunch of generals. You're shaped by the institution, by the career, and so forth. And then I would also say that it's important to remember that, you're shaped by your institution. Generals have their own limitations as they think about politics. They are not innately political animals, at least most of the ones that I know. Mm. And so they're going to have limits. And I hate the idea that we think that competence in this country is reserved to senior military officers. There are a lot of extremely competent leaders, organizers, managers who are not in the military. And there is something of a danger of a kind of soft militarism in this, which I think any citizen should reject.
Elliot Cohen is with us. We've got callers for you. Asa in Baltimore. Asa, thanks for calling. You're on the air with Elliot Cohen.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. So I appreciate the unease of having generals and military in White House positions. However, I do feel that we've been a nation at war for 16 years, and past presidencies that we've had have either invaded countries that really shouldn't against the advice of the generals, and we've had rules of engagement that really haven't helped us win anything or help us lose grounds that we've had people killed to achieve, like Afghanistan and Iraq, like we've seen what's been going on lately. I feel that having generals, especially Mattis, in the Secretary of Defense, may help us finally, you know, win these wars and get us out of there.
Asa, let me put it to Elliot Cohen. There's a view, and Asa, I see a note here saying he's got lots of friends in the military. He's got a brother in the military. Happy to have a military man. May help us win. How do you look at that?
Well, I understand that point of view, but I think there's another side to it as well. Again, let me just remind you, I did testify to the Senate to help get the law waived, changed, so that Mattis could be there.
This is the law from after World War II saying you can't go straight from the military into civilian at top of the Defense Department. They wanted a firewall there.
Right. It was originally a 10-year requirement, then a 7-year requirement. And I think it's a very good thing, actually, that you want a civilian in charge of the Defense Department normally. This is an exceptional case. So a couple of thoughts about this. First, it's not always clear that the best person to run a war from the point of view of civilian leadership is somebody who's military. There are two countries that tried it during the 20th century. One was Imperial Japan during World War II. The other was Imperial Germany during World War I, both of which were run by generals, and in neither case were the outcomes particularly good. I would also say that, you know, one of the issues that we deal with is these general officers have been conditioned by 16 years of, you know, very difficult times and repeated combat tours in these places. One of the problems that we face is that our most important strategic challenges are actually probably not in these places. And yet, for completely understandable
reasons— You mean not in Iraq, not in Afghanistan? Is that what
correct,
you mean?
Correct. Correct. They are and I'm sure we'll be discussing this. It's Europe. It's East Asia, particularly the rise of China, and other things. And there is, I think, something of a danger that, again, for completely understandable reasons, people will not be willing to simply to say, yes, I understand the sacrifices we've made. I am not, however, going to devote most of my attention to that. I'm rarely sympathetic to Donald Trump, but he had a certain point when apparently he was asking, well, you know, what are we doing in Afghanistan? And do we really think that we're going to be successful? The further problem I would say to Asa is that, unfortunately, is the nature of these wars that particularly Afghanistan, but also Iraq, we will not achieve a clean victory and then bring the boys home. That's just not the way it's going to work. And I understand what that feels like. I mean, I waited out my son having two combat tours in Iraq. So I understand what the families go through. But that, I think, is just the fact of the matter. You're not going to get a clean-cut victory. And it's really important, actually, for political leadership to be clear with the American people about that.
Larry in Buffalo, New York. Larry, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. Two points to make. One, having all of the military folks there in the White House structure signifies to me that Trump doesn't have the social network to know enough people to bring into the White House apparatus, the people with the knowledge and the abilities to do the work that is required from positions in the White House. And so he's bringing in the people who can do work but are kind of under mandate to serve the president in the capacity that they are best at doing, because he does not have alternatives or others who could do the work for
him. Yeah, okay, okay.
And second, I see bringing in more military leaders who, even in fact, when are very effectual in their own right, they also bring in kind of the same mindset that Trump seems to bring to all of his business practice and all of his policymaking so far, which is he is a bilateral, short-term thinking person. And we tend to have problems that are more of a long-natured, multilateral, multi-solution, multi-partnered effort.
Larry, we've got it. Our time is short before the break. Elliot, we've just got half a minute here. Does he have a problem with who's willing to work with and for him?
He undoubtedly does, and military people always respond to the call of duty. I think the I would put the challenge of the military mindset a little bit differently. I think they're used to order and discipline and regular staff processes, and politics is often not like that.
Yeah, and of course, foreign relations are politics, or politics by other means when it comes to war. We've got some of that for a long time now. Elliot Cohen, influential in the beginning of the Iraq War, in that coming on, Donald Trump very critical of that. A lot of water under the bridge since then. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Elliot Cohen, big conservative foreign policy hawk, big critic of Donald Trump, about the Trump administration and American foreign policy right now. He's professor at Johns Hopkins University's School of Advanced International Studies. He was an advisor to, a counselor to Condoleezza Rice when she was Secretary of State, 2007 to 2009 in the George W. Bush administration, a big proponent of the Iraq War. We will look at that. You can join us this hour. How do you see the American profile in the world under President Donald Trump? Anna Marie writes us on Facebook, Elliot Cohen says, on its face, it's startling. She's talking about all the generals. However, at this point, I think the presidents create stability. They're a counterweight to 45's erratic behavior. Elliot Cohen, can we take a bit of a tour of the world here? I don't know where to start. Maybe North Korea. It's been the most imminent in the last few weeks. What about the way the Trump administration is handling this problem, crisis, you name it?
Well, to begin with, I suppose one has to be fair and say they inherited an extremely difficult situation, and the trajectory is basically for the North Koreans to develop a substantial nuclear arsenal. Other administrations have tried either cutting a deal or getting the Chinese to do something. Those have both failed. There have been sanctions. They've delayed it. But what the unique contribution of the Trump administration is, first, to pick a fight with our South Korean ally just as we go into this by saying – the president saying he wants to cancel the
free trade
agreement. Mm-hmm. And then by making these quite reckless threats, which they will probably not follow through on. And, you know, Trump has done an extraordinary job of destroying American credibility around the world. And you get to a very dangerous world when neither your friends nor your enemies believe you'll follow through on the things you say. And that is already where he has taken us.
Here's President Trump in early August in response to North Korea. He was talking here at his golf club in Bedminster, New Jersey.
North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen.
Elliot Cohen, let's stick with that for a second. You say that these are reckless threats and they have implications. What implications when it comes to this difficult challenge with North Korea?
Look, sooner or later, whether it's North Korea or anything else, you can't really segment each of these challenges. A president has to be able to say, if you do X, we're going to do Y, and everybody to believe him, that consequences will follow. And, you know, this is the problem that President Obama had with the red line in Syria, which turned out not to be a red line. Well, Trump has already done that, I think, in a much bigger way. Of course, he might also trigger a really large war on the Korean Peninsula, which could be catastrophic, not just killing hundreds of thousands of people, but probably igniting a wave of nuclear proliferation and really turning our relationships in East Asia upside down. So it's another one of those cases where the fact that he knows so little and has such little restraint in speaking about foreign policy gets us into trouble with both our allies and our enemies.
Are you saying then that the U.S. at this point has to accept a nuclear-armed North Korea? I mean, that makes people pretty uneasy, especially when North Korea talks about hydrogen bombs, intercontinental ballistic missiles reaching the United States and all the rest.
It makes me very uneasy. But the stark alternatives that we face are, are we willing to launch a preventive war, not a preemptive war, but a preventive war? We're going to attack them because we worry about them in the long term. Or do we fall back on some mixture of deterrent threats and aid to South Korea and Japan and additional sanctions, perhaps with a view to putting the kind of pressure on the regime that might eventually help bring it down? Those are the two unpalatable choices that we have. And between those two choices, I would reluctantly say I want the second. I don't want Donald Trump taking this country into a preventive war in the Korean Peninsula.
I want to look beyond North Korea. Let's take a call for Sophia in Bangor, Maine. Sophia, you're on the air with Elliot Cohen.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. I'm very concerned about our State Department. I don't understand what's happening. I view Rex Tillerson as way more of a worry than any general, which I think this president needs the generals, and I'm surprised I would say that, but I agree with Mr. Cohen. They are needed. But what is happening with the State Department? What is going on with Rex Tillerson? He's decimating our State Department. I read about lack of ambassadorships, about offices being shuttered, about the lights being turned off. We will go to war if we don't have a strong State Department, and I guess I'd like a comment on that.
Thank you, Sophia. What's going on? What implications at the State Department?
Well, unfortunately, I completely agree with you. And part of the damage is done by Trump. The OMB director, Mick Mulvaney, said Trump doesn't believe in soft power. This is a hard power budget, and that's why they want to cut the State Department by 30%. And there's clearly a contempt for diplomacy there, which emanates from the Trump White House. I have to say that Secretary of State Tillerson has made it a lot worse. I still have a lot of friends and connections there from my own days at the State Department. It is profoundly demoralizing. It's completely unnecessary.
Why? How? What?
Part of this is just the management style of Rex Tillerson, who brings in it's typical kind of it's a sort of clueless corporate America. I'm going to bring in a management consultant who knows nothing about diplomacy and have them tell me how to reorganize the State Department. Part of it is he surrounded himself with a very small coterie of aides. He's not taken advantage of the terrific career people who are there, who ask only to serve, whether it's a Republican or a Democratic administration. He's been dreadful at the public presentation of American foreign policy. That's why it's so incredibly foolish to have kicked the press off the plane on his many trips abroad. He's kind of kowtowed to America First, which has some toxic overtones, as we all know. So he's taken a really bad hand and somehow managed to make it worse.
There's a lot of talk that he's headed out, that Nikki Haley may be headed in. What do you think of that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think that personally Tillerson, like the generals we've talked about, are decent, honorable man, and I am sure that there's plenty about Donald Trump that he finds odious, as I'm sure there's plenty about Trump that the generals find odious. And I can imagine him quitting over that. I can also imagine him quitting when you have a White House that really doesn't in some ways allow him to actually do his job. But I would keep on coming back to the central point. The fundamental problem of the Trump administration is Donald Trump. And good people around him can mitigate some of the damage. They can perhaps prevent a really catastrophic, catastrophically stupid decision from going down. But as long as Donald Trump is president, we're going to be in a very difficult position internationally with damage that will be done that will be lasting.
The president said again yesterday that he'd spoken again with Xi Jinping, the leader of China, that they had a good agreement on North Korea and the nuclear problems there. What about the handling of China in this era and the challenge of China looking forward?
Well, what you just said was a conversation with Xi Jinping. My guess is that Donald Trump does not think about countries. He thinks about individuals. This is his reality TV and New York real estate background talking. And sometimes he will be he blows hot and cold over people. And I mean, that's true. Just look at how he treats the Republicans or, for that matter, the Democrats on Capitol Hill. He can be extraordinarily insulting, and then he can be very, very accommodating. One of the things that's dangerous about all this is Donald Trump is actually a very easy man to read. You know, if you're one of the psychological profilers in any foreign intelligence agency, this is an easy assignment. Among other things, the president lets you know what's always going on with his inner self through a torrent of tweets, which, I mean, that may sound ridiculous, but that's a goldmine for an intelligence analyst. You know exactly what he's thinking all the time. What are his hot buttons? What are the things that he likes? And so I think one of our long-term challenges is going to be this man will be easily played by foreign leaders, and to some extent already is. And that most definitely includes the Chinese.
Are we managing the relationship with China well? They are very big and getting much bigger in the global economy, their military profile.
Not particularly. I mean, so again, some of the problems are structural. The rise of China poses a tremendous challenge for American foreign policy because they're going to be a major trade partner. There are going to be lots of Chinese students coming here. We obviously want a good and a peaceful relationship with them. On the other hand, the Chinese are interested, I think, in kind of pushing us out of East Asia. They clearly think of themselves as having a kind of regional hegemonic position that's at odds with ours. And then – so it's difficult to begin with. Trump, in his own way, of course, makes it worse when you begin loose talk about saying, well, we're going to slap trade sanctions on any country that trades with North Korea. Well, that includes China.
Mm, in a very big way.
In a really big way. And again, it'll be – it's a threat – which will undoubtedly prove to be hollow.
I mean, the U.S. economy really would not function without its trade relations with China right now. What do you think is in all those Apple phones?
Precisely. And you know, again, part of the damage that this president may do is to a global free trading order, which we helped build. I mean, just look at the way he goes on these tirades about free trade agreements with Korea or NAFTA. You know, the relatively benign world that we inhabit with incredible prosperity and ability to go places and the openness that we have all benefited from, this is not a natural order. This was something that was built by generations of American statesmen, Democrats and Republicans, since World War II. And it can be destroyed. And Donald Trump is doing his level best.
We're talking with Elliot Cohen. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Russia. The president came in to office with warm words for Vladimir Putin. It's gotten a lot trickier since then. And of course, we've seen all this, the intelligence reports of Russian meddling in the U.S. elections and the complications around that, the Robert Mueller investigation that goes on. In foreign policy terms, what's at stake here in the Russian relationship and the way this White House handles it?
Well, Russia is one of a number of challenges that the United States faces in terms of regional powers like Iran, in a somewhat different way, North Korea, which have, again, regional aspirations, which don't like the international order, particularly don't like the American nature of that order, and want to reshape their immediate environments. I think the Russians also very much want to take us down a peg. There is a very curious thing about this administration's policy towards Russia. The institutional policy towards Russia actually has continuity with the Obama administration. So, you know, Congress imposes sanctions. We eventually kick out a bunch of Russian diplomats after they kick out ours. The intelligence community, the Defense Department are extremely wary of Russia. But then you have the president, a president who clearly has some sort of admiration for Vladimir Putin, whose son has said that there was a lot of Russian money in the Trump organization. I'm sure we'll find out more about that. On whose behalf we know the Russians intervened in the last election. I mean, the Russians didn't just intervene in a neutral way. They intervened to help Trump. And we do know that he goes nuts whenever people begin talking about this probe. So it's an extremely peculiar situation, and it is very unsettling. The president cannot really bring himself to be critical of Vladimir Putin. And again, that's dangerous. I mean, one of the things that is dangerous is the Russians have really never accepted the idea that NATO would persist after the Cold War. And I think there is a serious danger that they will do some things, particularly in the Baltic states, which would normally evoke a NATO response. It doesn't happen. And then that's the end of NATO. And that's NATO has been the cornerstone of American foreign policy since 1948. And that is a scary thing.
Let's look at Iraq, ISIS, the Middle East. You were a big voice in helping take us into the Iraq war. Many people have looked back on that with tremendous regret. Donald Trump was very critical of that on the campaign trail, saying, look, this cost us trillions. This was a big, big mistake. There was a vision in the days before the war of a transformed Middle East. That has not worked out. We're still there all these years later. What have you taken from the cost of that war to us, you know, in blood and treasure, as everybody says at this point, and the continuing ramifications?
Well, we only have a few minutes left, so in part I would refer people to my book, which has a chapter called 15 Years of War, in which I do reflect on that. I mean, clearly, the intelligence premise of that war was mistaken. I shared that.
Weapons of mass destruction.
Yes. It's understandable, but it was mistaken. Certainly, that war was not well handled in the first few years, and I talked a lot about that. At the time, I have to say, I spent a lot of time in Iraq when I was in government, and my feeling towards the end of 2008 was that it was on some kind of fragile trajectory to success. And that's not just my own view. That was the view of career people like Ryan Crocker, Jim Jeffrey, very able diplomats who served as our ambassadors there.
And pretty fragile, if true, though.
Fragile, but successful. Look, you know, I could walk around the streets of Baghdad in 2008 in a way which I could not on my first visit in 2004. And even if you look at the Iraqi government today, you would say it's a lot better than what they had before, and there is potential.
It looks like Iran's territory, though, now, from Syria through Iraq through Tehran. I mean, is that the outcome you envisioned when you pushed for this war?
No, that's not – again, you know, the problem with Iraq is it is so easy to make sweeping generalizations. It's an extremely complicated place.
But isn't it pretty much a zone of Iranian influence now?
It is to some extent, yes. But, for example, the Iraqi prime minister recently was actually fairly critical of the Iranians and of Hezbollah, which is an Iranian instrument, for cutting a deal with the Islamic State that would let people get away. It is a complicated place. I would say I think we have made matters worse. I will also say I think a lot of those mistakes were made by the Obama administration. There is plenty of blame to go around on Iraq, but there is a real danger, you know, if people simply obsess about the Iraq war. And if that is, you know, kind of the bloody shirt that people are going to wave whenever we have a discussion about foreign policy, we're not going to be able to have much of a sensible discussion about anything.
There's a lot to talk about, but there's a lot of blood there also. How are you sleeping for these next 3 years of the Trump administration on the foreign policy front?
Not well.
Elliot Cohen, author of The Big Stick, The Limits of Soft Power and the Necessity of Military Force. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
Elliot Cohen, professor at Johns Hopkins University's School of Advanced International Studies, directs the Philip Merrill Center for Strategic Studies there, a big proponent of the Iraq War. Conservative foreign policy hawk with us today. Thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.